This Do Lectures episode features associate editor of British newspaper The Observer and author Robert McCrum, sharing his belief that telling stories is the way we make sense of our lives, recorded live at the Global Event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2016.
When I was at Hay years ago, Bill Clinton said he said about Hay that it was the Woodstock of the mind, and I think this is the Abbey Road of the mind. It's been a truly remarkable experience, and we've had our minds blown. By the way, I'm not a startup, I'm not a CEO. I am chairman, I'm in charge of publicity and HR, of course, I can fire myself. And I've just sacked the IT department, so there's no visual prompt, just words. Because I'm a writer and a journalist, and words are my business. Black on white. Very simple. And one of the themes of this session, or these sessions, has been curiosity. And my first thought about curiosity was that curiosity is what kills the cat. So it's bad news for cats. But I also want to say that curiosity is something which you might have. I'm sitting on this stool and I'm using a stick because I have lived for the last 21 years in the shadows of life and death. And in the course of those 21 years, I've discovered, amongst other things, that we are all ill in one way or another. That's a quote actually from the poet Keats. But illness is something which shadows our lives. And although we're here to celebrate things, I also want to say there's a dark side, and it is that which love addresses and which purpose addresses. But nonetheless, that is in our situation. And I want to tell you a story about myself 21 years ago on the 28th of July, 1995, when, to pick up a theme of these sessions, my personal narrative. I mean, I think narrative is storytelling is one of the things which underlines all of these sessions, and telling stories is the way we make sense of our lives. And on that date, the 28th of July, 1995, my personal narrative got, if not broken, certainly interrupted. So what happened? Well, I was 42 years old, and I was at that point in the world of words and books and communication. I was the editor-in-chief of Faber and Faber, the publishers, who published writers like T.S. Eliot, Harold Pinter, and so forth. And in the morning of that day, which was a Friday, I'd been to the gym, I'd done all the things that one did in those days to fend off the inexorable progress of aging. And in the evening, I went out for supper with a friend, had one glass of champagne, or maybe two, can't really remember, actually. And as I walked away from the restaurant to go home to my house, I felt that my legs were, it felt like walking through treacle or walking with lead boots. And if I'd known what I know now, I would have called 99, I would have dialed 999. But I actually had just recently got married and I was going home to call my wife who was away in San Francisco. So I was eager to get home. So I went home, feeling a bit groggy, and made the call, couldn't reach her, left a message, felt not great, made a cup of tea and went up to bed. And during the night of the 28th of July, 21 years ago, 1995, I had a stroke, what's called a right side hemorrhagic infarct, which is probably a blockage and then a bleed. And then I woke up in early morning of the Saturday the next day, completely paralyzed, and particularly completely paralyzed down my left side. And this was about eight in the morning or thereabouts, and I could hear the phone ringing downstairs. And my first thought was, and I commend this to you as an epistemological thought, which is that I didn't know what had happened. And I was just baffled by the experience. It had come as a complete surprise, and I also commend it to you as an eruption of reality into a life which at that point seemed rather blessed and seamless. So I'm lying in bed, not knowing what's happened to me. I'd never heard of a stroke, or the reality of it. And the phone was ringing, and I thought, well, I must get downstairs to answer the phone, although I was unable to move, lying in this bed and with the phone ringing, thinking I had to get to the phone somehow. And there was also a phone by the bedside. When I rolled towards the bedside table to pick up the phone, I fell out of the bed onto the floor, so that I was now like Alice in Wonderland in the Lewis Carroll story. The phone was above me, and I was lying on the floor, and I was paralyzed, so I couldn't move. So in the course of the morning, I crawled under the bed and down the stairs to find the phone in the living room on the floor downstairs. This took about most of the day, in fact, most of the day of the 29th of July, 1995. And by the close of play, as the light was fading outside, and you could hear the street sounds changing, I managed to reach the phone and call. In fact, I didn't call my nan, I called my mum, which I also recommend to you as an example of how to take up Holly's point about love. What did I want to do in that situation? In extremis, I turned to my mother's phone number and called her in Cambridge. And there was a funny side to this, by the way. The house I was living in had belonged to Salman Rushdie. And when I'd moved in a year or two before, the police had given me a number to call in an emergency, which I wasn't able to do, but she called the police, and they thought this was an example of an attack on one of Rushdie's supporters. So they were around at tremendously high speed, and they broke through the door. And they were very disappointed when they discovered I was just lying on the floor, wanting to be helped. There's a great saying from the French essayist Montaigne. He says, "We laugh and cry at the same thing." And it's incredibly true. So there were funny things and there were dark things. I was at this point being carried out on a stretcher into an ambulance. And again, I can tell you from this experience, which was very strange, that I had the brain is merciful. And I was very detached from what was going on. I felt quite serene, strangely, although I was probably hovering between life and death at this particular point, I felt quite serene and strangely interested in my situation. It seemed quite, you know, quite intriguing. Anyway, I was swept off to University College Hospital in Bloomsbury. And after two or three days of hanging in by a bit of a thread, began to recover. And this is one of the things about stroke, which is there are various ways you can die. Cancer is one, obviously, heart attack, but stroke is the third biggest killer, and it kills about 150,000 people a year in Britain. So during the session, about 10 people will have had some kind of stroke in England. And of those 10, probably a third will have died. So it's quite a serious illness. But anyway, I survived after this that first weekend, and I began to come to terms with my situation. And there's been a lot of talk about change and the interaction of change in our lives and work. And I began to feel that this change actually wasn't such a bad, the change that was happening to me wasn't so bad. And there were three things about this change which I again want to commend to you, which was first of all, that I was slowed right down. I was less paralyzed than I was paralyzed just on one side, now able to speak a little bit and beginning to see a way forward. But I had to really come to terms with slowness. And I also had to come to terms with solitude. One of the things about being a patient is that you are exposed to solitude and loneliness, and particularly at night. The nights in hospital are the worst thing you can ever go through. You're lying there, you're thinking you're going to die, because I was afraid that there would be some kind of follow-up. This is the way most people die from strokes, is but second strokes. And so you're alone, and when you're alone, you're very aware of how lonely you actually are. The solitude feeds on itself. And the third lesson of all this was that as I began to discover I wasn't going to die and things were going to get better, I found the world an incredibly wondrous place. I felt. I became occasionally overwhelmed by tearfulness at the beauty of the world. And it's one of those experiences which I wish I could bring back, because the world is an extraordinary place, and I can't quite get back to that state of mind that I was in all those years ago. But all I can remember was it just seemed the most extraordinary experience to be alive in the world, having not been on the edge of not being alive in the world. So that was wonder. And during this period, I haven't got it to hand, it's on the chair there, that book. The only thing that was working on my, I was lying on the bed, the only thing that was working was my right hand worked. And my brain was working, and I could speak a bit. And I hadn't lost my memory. My stroke was a right side stroke, which had gone to the left side of my body. So I didn't lose memory, I didn't lose speech. And I had one of these. I've always had one of these. And I began to make notes about the experience in this notebook, or one like this. I've now lost it, rather annoyingly. But I began to make notes, and I began, this goes to what both of the previous speakers have talked about, I began to construct a narrative of my daily life. I began to keep a diary. And the diary grew, and people heard about it, and it became an article, and then ultimately it became a book. And the book was called My Year Off. And it's still in print, and every time someone falls ill, it's referred to by the media, and I'm very proud of it. It's a worm's eye view of what it's like to be very seriously ill at the age of 42, which was not an experience I particularly wanted, but it's one which I survived, and strangely, I'm grateful for in hindsight. Because as I said earlier on, my experience was pretty interesting. It's a lot more interesting than much of my life at that particular juncture, which I was in some ways getting. One of the speakers this morning was saying that they talked about going into business because they were bored with what they were doing. And in a way, the illness became a substitute for tedium. And then, as I got better over a 3 or 4 year period, I began to renew my curiosity, to come back to our theme, and to try to come to terms with what had happened. And again, this goes to what both the previous speakers talked about. I became obsessed by the brain. Now, the brain is 1.4 kilograms. It's about the weight of a bag of sugar. But it is everything. It is, you know, Mark, it is your character, your language, the way you stand on the stage here, the way you're nodding your head, everything about the brain, your brain, which is this organ, which I've held one. It's an extraordinary sensation. And it is you, your personality, everything about you. And I became very obsessed about the brain and consciousness and related issues. And in fact, at the moment, in medicine, neurology is the front line of biochemical research, because it is the last frontier. We know an awful lot about the human body, but the brain remains a profound mystery. And I was already interested in the idea of the mystery of life, and the idea of the mystery of the brain was one with which I have become obsessed and fascinated. And the more you look into it, the more fascinating it becomes. Because we only meet one brain, which is we can only meet the one thing which creates us, and so this consciousness is in our heads, and yet it is our entire world. The world of here is in that organ. It's when you start to think about it, it's completely mind blowing. And one of the things about the human animal is that its brain. This is why we are unique. The human animal is the only animal that knows that it is born to live and die. And here's the bad news. It's not going to get any better, and it's not going to end well. It's a one-way street with no exit, or with only one exit. And yet, we practice cognitive dissonance, which is that we live as though we're immortal. All the talks this morning were predicated on the idea that we're going to live forever. It was actually fascinating to listen to them, because it's an account of everyday life based on immortality. And yet, We know that's not the case. But in the words of the TV series, we're all doomed. So how do we deal with this? And this is what I'm, this is in a way, this is where I want to end. And I want to pick up on the James and Holly's talk. How do we reconcile these two thoughts, which is that we continue to live as though we live forever, and yet we know that there's a limit to it. We have to make a reconciliation, and I would suggest that the reconciliation is made through love and through effort, purpose. So love and purpose, your two themes. As I said, I don't have a PowerPoint, but I have got 5 points, which I want to very briefly mention. I think I have learned 5 lessons from this experience. One is that we do indeed laugh and cry at the same thing. It's very important to me. I mean, I think sense of humour alongside a sense of fate is quite important. Second thing, things change. We live in a changing environment. And in those changes, I would say it's love, not money, that's important. One of my experiences as a survivor of this experience was I was sustained by the love of family, my wife, my children, my parents, my a whole range of people who performed in a way that was unimaginable. My third point is, I think, which is a slowness point, which I commend to you very strongly, that less is more, things should be slowed down. Keep it simple. I think one of the things about becoming very nearly dead is that you do suddenly see what's really important, and you just keep it simple. My fourth one, which comes from Winston Churchill, always used to say, during World War II, KBO, keep buggering on. There's a lot to be said for keep buggering on. And finally, I think one of my lessons would be, and it's a very important one to me, is that has been exemplified by this experience of being at the DOO lectures, which has been a great privilege, and thank you again, David. Live in the moment. Live for now, make the most of it, extract all you possibly can from it, because you never know what's going to happen. Thank you very much.
The DOO Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or, if you prefer, watch on our website, thedoolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out. For our weekly curation of wonder and optimism, sign up to our newsletter by visiting thedoolectures.com/newsletter.